Blog Talk Radio.
Prophecy Keepers Radio.
This is Yasagonige, Will Blue Otter, a seventh grade grandson of Samanuka, keeper of the Holy Cherokee Ark, who during the American Revolution became first beloved man of the Cherokee, head man of the Upper, Middle, and Lower Cherokee. Please join us at 5 p.m. Pacific Time on Sunday evening and learn how you, regardless of ancestry, may gain the privilege of worshiping as you please, even using indigenous, plant-based, native sacraments. Aho. You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Anawehis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's a 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's a 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. OCO, Ginalii, this is Blue Otter coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau, the ancient home of the Aniuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the Cherokee Nation.
Hello, everybody. This is your old buddy, Blue Otter, coming to you from Booger County, Mysterious Ozarks in Mid-America. And our guest this week is Chief AJ from ChiefAJ.com. And we're going to be talking about his book, Tsunami Twins. And how are you, Chief?
Well, I'm real good.
Well, welcome to the show. You know, there's quite a few prophecies about the cleansing, of, particularly about the Southwest. You have a friend who's a chiropractor, I guess, in the Oklahoma area that contacted me, told me about your book, and her screen name is Red Ryder. I can't remember her her name, but she was kind of excited to get you on. So tell us a little bit about yourself and your history, and how you came to write this book.
Well, it's been a year and a half development, but I've been given this spiritual insight. It all started August 31st in 2003 at Raven Den Springs, Arkansas, where we have one of our tribal offices. Now, that's deep in the Ozark Hills. And we were having a baptismal service, and we were baptizing several people there in James Creek. People were standing on a gravel bar singing Amazing Grace, which is the Cherokee national anthem.
Uh-huh.
And as we were finishing up baptizing people in the name of the Father and the Son and of the Holy Ghost, it was like the heavens opened up, and we had a revelation that our tribe would start being spiritual and we'd be a living page in the New Testament. And that's when all the prophecies and the speaking in tongues and the revelations and the dreams and the visions all started coming.
Fascinating.
And so it's been developed over a year and a half now about this cleansing of the desert Southwest. And I was led to start studying about the giant waves, or the wave known as the tsunami. And an inland tsunami that's going to happen in the desert southwest of all places. And then our tribal headquarters at Raven Den Springs, we got a request to send money to this big university that was doing an archaeological study in the west end of the Grand Canyon. And, of course, they wanted us to contribute money because this would be an important cultural event for Native Americans. And our chief down there, Chief Walkstall, and I describe him in the book there, and I describe this is how the book opens there in our tribal office at Raven Den Springs, and he gets to laughing about white man wanting money from us Indians, and he really gets to laughing, and we're all sitting around, we want to know why he's laughing so hard, and he says, well, I'm not going to send them money, I'm going to send them our tribal archaeologist. If they really think it's important, we better have a tribal archaeologist there. So he sent me out to the west end of the Grand Canyon, and that's where I got the enlightenment on what's about to happen there at the Colorado River and Lake Mead.
You know, it's happened before. They've proven that there have been major landslides that have stopped up the...
Well, geologists know of at least three major events
right.
where it was dammed up, and one time it was dammed up over 150 years before it cleansed itself out. And then as I got to studying about what the light that I was being given about what's going to happen, I read where a 1905 white man tried to dam up the Colorado River. And it broke. And the floodwaters came on out into Central California. Now, Central California is 200 feet below sea level. And a white man's dam broke on the Colorado River, and the water flowed on in there and made what's now Salton Sea on the map of Southern California. And there was factories, there was farms, there was cities, there were towns, there was thousands of people that died in that. And there was never much mention of that. The government tried to keep it secret, and back then, in 1905, there wasn't any recompense for losing your property or anything in a man-government-caused flood.
Well, there wasn't a constitution. They just didn't get paid for it. It's down by El Centro, down in southern Salton Seas down in, I've been down there. It's a real wreck down there.
Yeah, as I was researching for my book, Tsunami Twins, I was driving through there. And there's one town that has a grain elevator, like we have grain elevators here in Illinois, and halfway up the elevator, about 100 foot over your head, there's a line drawn that says sea level. Now that's scary enough. Back in the mid-1800s, you said that there was other prophecies about this cleansing. Well, the Tula tribe in the mid-1800s was moving out, and a newspaper reporter from Imperial, California, he went and he asked the chief, he says, what's going on? He said, ocean coming back. We moved to Yosemite. Yeah, so I got sent out there, and I got to on this dig, and we dug up some important things, and so when I wrote this book, Tsunami Twins, I wrote it up just as it happened, a year and a half worth of events of real people in real places, some with fictitious names, and I did add a little bit of romance so I could get people to read the warning, because you have me on the radio here, Blue Otter, it might just save thousands of lives.
Very well, because that's what we're trying to do, is get people to be a little bit more aware of at least what's going on in the spirit world, so that the people are being warned, so they can just be a little bit more prudent about where they live.
Well, I thought of all kind of ways of putting out the warning. And then I realized that if I wrote it up in a book, in a novel, and put it out with an interesting story, that people would be more likely to read it. And I also put some comments in there about Homeland Security and the way that they're guarding Boulder Dam. And I also had to poke a little bit of fun at white men, too, about how he's running a war in the Middle East and all these things. So when the big catastrophe comes there in the book, the governor of Arizona and the governor of Nevada and the governor of California, they go to call out the National Guard to help with things, and they, you know, they get a PFC on the phone. And this one governor in the book there, he says, I want to call out the guard in the private first class. He says, well, governor, that'd be a long-distance call. They're all over there in the sandbox.
Yeah.
And most of the machinery that would help in a big disaster and everything has now been moved over to Iraq.
Yeah.
Well, I'm getting kind of sidetracked there and everything, but on the way out to the west end of the Grand Canyon, I made a little side trip there in New Mexico to the lava ice caves. Have you ever seen a natural ice cave?
No, I sure haven't.
Well, in lava formations, there's lots of tubes. They call them lava tubes.
Mm-hmm. They have Play-Doh also.
Yeah, and the only solid lava flows are plasma flows. Now, Yucca Mountain, where the government's digging tunnels now to try to store nuclear waste, that's a plasma flow that's solid, but most lava flows, I learned there, have tubes and everything, and when a tube has a smaller opening at the bottom than the top, it makes a natural ice cave.
Hmm.
And it's like when you go in a grocery store and they have an open freezer there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I found out about these natural ice caves, and then when I got to the west end of the Grand Canyon and I got to learned out about Chaco Man, the wise man of the Chaco Society, and I got to follow him, the rock art that he left down there, I got to this place on Lake Mead, which of course was the Colorado River, these huge lava deposits. They're pretty near 3,000 feet high on either side of the narrows, where Lake Mead's only about 70 feet wide. And they were littered with these natural ice caves. Well, white man dams up the Colorado River. He builds Hoover Dam. 18 miles now upstream from Hoover Dam is where this narrows is, and all this cracked lava flow, and it had these natural ice caves. White man makes a whole big thing of warm water. You know, it's heated by the sun. Well, it melted the ice out of these ice caves. And that has caused all kind of cracks and seismic activity going on there. And I did set up my website so you can see this as it developed, as I was learning about this and getting the spiritual insight. I put it there on my website, and if you click on
Hoover Dam.
Hoover Dam.
Right.
Right. Now, there's a picture of Hoover Dam there, and what I want you to notice about that is the water is down about 90 feet, and it's left a white calcium deposit, like a ring in a bathtub.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, water seeks its own level. A white man sent me to college, and I learned all this physics, you know, like water seeks its own level. And the ring around Lake Mead there is absolutely level from the north to the south there to dam. Now, if you click down there at the bottom, it says we're going to the narrows. If you click on the narrows, and then I've got a picture. I rented a boat at the Caldwell boat dock, and I run down to the narrows, and you'll notice that the high water mark from the north side to the south side is way different. It's way uneven.
Oh, yeah.
Now, there is your physical evidence of what the book of twin tsunamis is all about. And when you get into that area, just to use a little New Age talking stuff, I mean, you're in a vortex. You can feel it. You pull a boat on around there, and you can feel the seismic activity going on in the bottom of that lake. You see, in order for those water lines to be uneven, and that's the only place in the whole length of Lake Mead where it's unlevel.
Hmm.
Now, because that is the narrows, that is the place back in 1935 and 36 when the engineers were studying about where to put Hoover Dam. That's where they wanted to put it because it would have cost them a whole lot less. But as they studied the rock, they saw all the cracks and the faults, and they saw all the things that were going on there and decided they couldn't build it there because it wouldn't hold water.
Yeah.
So at the bottom of my narrows page, if you click on that, we're going to do an examination of the 1,000-foot of lava that's sticking out of the water on either side there. Did you find that all right?
Mm-hmm.
And okay, the top picture there, I got my little notebook here. Yeah, that should be the crack in the mountain. Can you see that whole crack running across the screen there?
That's remarkable.
Right, and then as you scroll down a little bit, you'll see kind of a square opening.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they mined for gold there in this porous lava at the Narrows.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just, they found a little bit of gold, and you know, when a white man finds a little bit of gold, you know what he does? He digs more, and he digs more, and he digs more. So, along with collapsing ice caves, we got all these mines and tunnels that they did in this rock. Now, the important thing of how high this lava is above this 500 foot of water there that's in the Narrows, it's 500 feet deep there. Well, I was up in Valdez, Alaska, and Valdez was wiped out by a tsunami from a landslide just across the fjord. About 300 yards away, a mountain slid on down into the ocean and made a tsunami that wiped out Valdez, Alaska.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, the scientific thing on the tsunamis and landslide is the size of the tsunami is proportionate to the height of the rock or the mountain that slides on down into the water. So you can see the height of this lava there in those photos, how far it is above the water. Then you go down another 500 foot. So from that mine photo, if you go on down, you'll see on the south side of these big lava flows above the Narrows, you'll see the rubble coming on down into the lake.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you get out of your boat and try to stand on that rubble, you can sense that there's something going on in that lake bottom. I mean, it doesn't take anybody very spiritual or aware. You can feel it rumbling there in the ground, and that rock is sliding down in there right now. Now, just below where the rubble's going into the lake, you'll see a drawing of the rock art that I found, and in the book, it's our tribal archaeologist named Two Bears, the Two Bears and Professor Pamela Parker from the big university. They're examining it together to make the story interesting, a little romance there.
That left-hand print of the creator there, that's all over the place.
Right. Now, if you scroll down, do you see that rock art where you see a...
The left-hand print in a crescent moon?
Right. Well, no, not that. I think you went too far. Yeah. Anyway, it's a black and white drawing, and the star at the top is the supernova of 1054.
Oh, yeah, the drawing. Yeah, I see that.
Yeah, the drawing. Yeah, that's the drawing that it took us a long time to interpret, and we took pictures of that, and we sat in our Cherokee dream cave there at Raymond Springs, Arkansas, and got spiritual insight on what that rock art left by Chaco Man from the Chaco Society of 950 years ago could possibly mean. And so we got to looking at it and was, well, Indians do things in story form. So we made a story out of it. So we have this wise man from the Chaco Society, and in the year that he saw two suns in the sky, which the supernova of 1054 AD was a nova of a sun that was 100 times bigger than ours, 600 light years away. It had been 600 light years getting there, and for 38 days it was like there was two suns visible from Earth, and they recorded this all around the world. And it happened, it started on July 4th, 1054. So, we interpret Chaco Man was trying to tell us in the year 1054, and then those three dots. And three dots is a warning now, and it always has been a warning. You know, a white man, if he gets lost hunting, he shoots his rifle three times. If an Indian shot three arrows, it wouldn't bring any help. But if a crow calls three times, he's warning other crows that, you know, there's danger and for them to fly off. So
we always, one of the things we talk about is the 3 days of darkness that is recurring, has happened before, and it's going to happen again.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Folks, the scriptures say, "My people perish for lack of knowledge." We live in a world that's becoming more and more dangerous as time goes by. Millions of people are aware of this fact now and are actively preparing. Back in 2004, the folks here at Prophecy Keepers Foundation foresaw this situation and began preparing information for you. Friends, I seriously suggest that you head over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look at the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library. The Prophecy Keepers Trilogy is a 1,000-page intelligence briefing. The trilogy is a sum total of many years of collecting, collating, analyzing, and comparing prophecies from all over the planet. Mad Bear Anderson predicted that someone would do exactly what we have done. Mad Bear passed into spirit in 1985 before he could realize his dream of collecting and comparing prophecies from all over the world. He said in his biography, "Someday someone will collect all the native people's prophecies, myths, and legends and would publish them in one place so they could be compared with those of all native peoples worldwide, and then we really will have something." And friends, you'll be absolutely shocked to find out that we discovered exactly what that something was that Mad Bear wanted everyone to know. As it turns out, that certain special something that Mad Bear was searching for in the prophecies has everything to do with your physical safety and how to protect it. Now folks, there's absolutely nothing available on the planet like this collection. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files in 222 folders. You'll also receive direct access to links that will allow you to download all past Prophecy Keeper's interviews. Now folks, I won't kid you, Prophecy Keeper's does need money to continue to operate. So please head on over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look.
Keepers of great wisdom, truth of other times, let the wind blow.
Listen, I couldn't get to sleep, but I was sitting, my wife was asleep up in the gooseneck of the fifth wheel, and I was awake on the couch. My first wife was asleep. And I was reading about 2 a.m. in the morning, and I smelled pipe, ceremonial pipe tobacco. And I woke Joanne up, and I said, "Joanne," I said, "do you smell tobacco smoke?" She said, "No." And I told her that I smelled it. And then later on, she didn't smell it right then, but later on, she did smell it and told me about it the next day. Well, she passed away the following April 29th. The following Christmas, I remarried Betty, and she's sitting right here, and she'll attest to it. And it's a matter of record because it was on the broadcast for me several of them a year ago. That the following Christmas night, after the stroke of midnight, you know, she and I were in my parents' house, 1,500 miles away from where I had been living. And no one had ever smoked in their house either. We're down in the basement in a big rumpus room down there. And my dad lived in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and he was a research scientist. And I'm sitting watching TV. Betty's on the bed, and I smelled this pipe tobacco again. And it was kind of like I had a feeling somebody was sitting next to me on the floor. And as I would lean over to the right, I could smell this tobacco, and I was able to do it time after time. And I was... So I remembered, oh my gosh, this is the second time now it's happened on the 20th. So I kept asking everybody I know. I asked Ted Silverhand. I asked Red Elk. I asked Ghost Wolf, "Does the 26th of December mean anything to you?" Well, I think I got the answer to what it meant, that something was going to happen.
Yeah, well, I guess we were predestined to talk because I was born on December 25th.
Isn't that something? Well, this both of these happened, you know, right after midnight, on the early morning of the 26th of December. And if I went back and, it kind of makes me wonder, you know, what time that tsunami happened on U.S., you know, Central Time, because it was, you know, 1, 2 a.m. in the morning. But, yeah, it's kind of interesting.
It probably all matches up.
Yeah, very possibly could. You know, I was told, I'm waiting for something to happen in August because I was told in 98 that I had, you have 7 years. I've had a voice that told me some things from time to time, including describing the time of the month that my wife would die. I was told in 82 that she would die during the dark of the moon, and 13 years later, you know, 10 days after she passed away, it occurred to me to look at the calendar. Sure enough, she died right in the middle of the dark of the moon. But I'm kind of waiting to see what this, you know, this voice told me, you have 7 years. And that was in, about the 10th of August of 98. And that's coming up here this August. So I'm kind of waiting for the next shoe to drop and kind of wondering what's going to happen in August.
Well, I'm going to stay in touch with you, Blue Otter.
Well, I don't know that it's going to be anything bad. It might just be, you know, we've got another listener out in California, and I was talking to him on the phone, and he said he had a similar warning, and nothing happened. And, but because I was told that, I really began to, it made me kind of angry, you know, because a lot of times that voice, you know, the Creator speaks to you, they can't really tell you a whole lot, because they can't, Creator can't go against your free agency, so he just drops hints, and you got to fill in a lot of the blanks. And that was the first time he really, Creator made me angry, so I immediately went back to him, and when he said, you have 7 years, I said, okay, I said in prayer, I said, you've been telling me all this stuff since 1982. Who are you? You know, I said, I have a good feeling about you, but, you know, we're told we're supposed to test spirits. Who are you? So about 10 days later, I woke up and a voice just very gently whispered, I am. And then he raised his voice almost to shouting and said, I am. So I woke up and I went, oh, okay, well, I know who you are, and, you know, and so,
absolutely, when you get an I am.
Yeah, now I know who, because I am, in the Old Testament, there are two names for God, the JWHW, the Yod-Heh-Vod-Heh, that people get Jehovah and Yahweh from. Those were not to be used. It says that was the forbidden name of God, and it was a representation of the name. But it said that anyone in the house of Israel was welcome to invoke the name of their God by saying Ehayah. And Ehayah translated means I am.
So that's, absolutely.
Yeah, and in the Old Testament, kind of depending on whether they were northern or southern kingdom, the southern kingdom used the Yod-Heh-Vod-Heh, but the Northern Kingdom used
Well, in this last year and a half or so, from August 31st, 2003, when I preach the Lord Jesus, I make reference to the Bible as ancient tribal writings.
Yeah, me too, as they were.
Yes, and if you think of that, it gives you a lot more understanding as ancient tribal writings, because what white man teaches, it came through the Middle East, and then it came through Europe, and white man watered it all down, and white man didn't think of it as ancient tribal writings from a tribal society that the Lord set up. And when you get to thinking about it as ancient tribal writings and how meaningful it is to Native American tribes and things, wow, it really makes a big difference.
Well, I don't know whether I've told this to listeners in the past, but you may have heard of the book, The History of the American Indian by James Adair, that was written about 1750. It's got 26 arguments in there that he believes that the Cherokees were descended from lost Israel. But when my teacher, John Red Hat, who was born into the original Kitsua Society, the Nighthawks, he was born into the Long-Haired Clan, which was the spiritual core of the Nighthawks, and the Nighthawks are the kind of the general authorities of the Cherokee religion. Anyway, he was brought up with two full-blood Cherokee grandmothers and a freed woman, a black woman. And they all spoke Cherokee fluently, but they spoke the so-called lost Ketua dialect. And John remembers that when they pronounced Ketua, they pronounced it with an R, and they trilled the R. So they would have pronounced Ketua, Ketura. And if you'll check your Bible, Keturah was the replacement wife that Abraham was given. He had two sons with her, and according to the, there's just a brief mention in the Old Testament about Keturah, K-E-T-U-R-A, according to the Hebrew University at Jerusalem, he sent her and the two boys away with a blessing that they would become a people and that their two biggest talents would be herbalism and the modern equivalent of shamanism. And, you know, we know from the Piri Reis map that the Phoenicians were plying the world's oceans at least 4,500 years ago because they made a map of the shoreline of Antarctica. So,
isn't that interesting? The mainstream says that the oceans were big barriers to those people. But I think those people saw the oceans as a highway.
Yeah, the Cherokees always had to have an outlet to the sea. It was the first land section we got rid of was a narrow length of land between Columbia and South Carolina and Charleston and the ocean. But there's really no other explanation for why Cherokee and Creek skull structure that's found in Cherokee and Creek graves and the Appalachians are long-headed, the dolichocephalic, and they match the Phoenician bone structure. And the only place in the world you can find these skulls and burials is either in coastlines, where Phoenicians were, or in the Appalachian mountain chain. So, plus, the Cherokees spoke a completely different language, and they looked different. Their heads weren't round like the other Indians, and they were a different group of people. Our ancient stories say that we migrated by boat and across the Eastern Ocean, and we inhabited an island off the shore of South America, and we had foreknowledge that it was going to sink because the elders were misusing something called white fire. So some of us left and came up here either in two waves or in two migrations. We may have migrated back and forth twice. But our homeland, it's been proven now by Dr. Timothy Jones, who was, he has a double doctorate in archaeology and ethnology. He's proven that the original homeland of the Cherokees was not in the southeast, but here in the Ozarks. Because there was a lot of archaeological data that lay around for a long time, and he was able to go, because he could come and go out of the BIA. He's a White House fellow and a National Science Foundation fellow. He recognized that there were a lot of stop grounds, and, you know, going back 800 years, and he was able to prove scientifically 800 years that these stop grounds were in Arkansas, and he said that when he gets time, he'd be able to prove it back 1,500 years. So we've always liked the mountains, but apparently in the past we were Siegling peace people also.
How far are you located from our office in Raven Denton Springs, Arkansas?
I don't know where that is. I'm in.
Well, have you heard of Jonesboro, Thayer, Paragu?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you're.
We're in the mountains, just about 30 miles from where it drops on down into the flat Mississippi Valley rice fields.
So,
Pocahontas is the county seat there.
Yeah, you're over kind of south Poplar Bluff. Yeah, I've been through that area.
Mm-hmm.
I think I know who, you mentioned a name earlier.
Roxtall.
Yeah, he used to be sergeant-at-arms for... same man. He was a sergeant at arms for Lola Shoal,
West
Cherokee Nation of. Yeah, I met him.
Right below our tribal office is a cave where, on the Trail of Tears, They tried to lock up a bunch of Cherokee in there, and they found a passage all out and went underneath the mountain ridge and escaped.
Well, there are some caves down in that area. You know, the Cherokees have the story about the moon people, and there was a couple of spelunkers that some years ago discovered a cave that went into an even deeper cave. They were down about a mile, and they said they were attacked by some kind of creatures were throwing big rocks at them. And they said that they were trying to encourage them to leave a certain area. So they ran these creatures off, whatever they were, and they went to a wall of the cave and they reported that they were able to look through the wall of the cave. There was one place where there was like a clear lucite plaster glass type tube, and they were able to see that there was building going on down there. Sounds like a wild story, but. You know, one of the first things the Cherokees encountered was the moon people, people that lived underground and came out to farm or garden. We encountered them when we got to the Ohio Valley and had a brief war with them. But they were very, very light or blue-skinned people, I understand, with large eyes.
Oh, Blue Otter, you're going to have me going way back in that cave. I can see that right now.
But yeah, that's one of the reasons why I'm here in the Ozarks, because of the water and the caves and the herbs are still the biggest herbal clearinghouse, mail order house in the world at Mountain Home. And there's a lot of advantages, and it's cheap cost of living down here too. But
now, if we would have met in person in the Cherokee tradition and everything, I've got a very special gift for you. And so I feel that we're going to meet, and when we do...
We'll meet sometime.
Yeah, from my heart, I will hand your special gift to you.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm looking forward to meet you sometime, too. So you were, I understand you were in the Marine Corps sometime at one time.
Well, when I turned 18, my uncle, he laid his hand on my shoulder, and he said Native Americans are forbidden to have a warrior society anymore, so he joined the Marine Corps.
Uh-huh.
So I did, yeah, I did. And, of course, that was just rifle shooting, and I was already a pretty good rifle shot, and that just made it even more so. And then after I got out of the Marine Corps, I've shot several world records with 22s and bows and arrows. And
yeah, that's what I understand.
It's just the Indian thing to do. I've been on the front cover of 14 Outdoors magazines shooting little blocks out of the air and shooting BBs out of the air and shooting pink balls out of the air, and it's, like I said, it's just an Indian thing to do.
Well, you know, when Colonel Bo Greitz was putting on his fight training sessions, they taught us the technique that was used, I guess, during the later years of Vietnam. What they would do is they'd give the soldiers air rifles because so much of the shooting was instinctive shooting. And he said what they would do, they'd start out with just a pump air rifle and a tin can. And you'd throw them up in the air and shoot them. And when you got good at shooting the tin can, then they would make the target smaller and smaller and smaller until they got down to the point where they could shoot an aspirin out of the air.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because it was just about 3 months ago, Daisy, that makes air rifles at Rogers, Arkansas, in Neosho, Missouri, they called me down there because they heard of all the shooting expositions that I put on, and I do some with air rifles, and I had designed an adult air rifle that could take the punishment of a bodybuilder cocking the thing and shooting thousands of rounds, and I showed them all the improvements that I made, and I have, right here in my living room, the prototype of the Chief AJ New Daisy air rifle.
Is it all pneumatic, or cock to open, you know, like the Beemans and the Gamos and some of those other ones?
No, it has a cocking lever,
okay.
And it has a piston that dries up there on the inside,
okay,
and it has a little tube that comes down as the piston goes up, the air is compressed into a tube.
Right. So it's like
behind the BB, yeah.
Like the old Red Ryder.
Yeah, type.
Gotcha, yeah, yeah.
But and I beefed it up and I put an adult stock on it and I made it so you could learn that instinct shooting with it. And
right.
I was talking to the head of Daisy down there and he said, now, Chief, he says, I'm all for this, but we get 400 requests a year on how we ought to build a BB gun. And he says, it ticks off our engineers.
Yeah.
So he says, I'm going to introduce you to four engineers, and if you can convince them, we'll probably do it. So he left me alone with these four engineers at Daisy, and I said, now this is what I want to do. So we went out in the parking lot, and these little paint balls, I started throwing them up in the air and hitting them and squirting the paint out, and I showed them how to do it. And they said, we're going to convince the head of Daisy we should do this BB gun.
Great sport.
Yeah, so... I've got on the box, I've even got a Christian testimony.
Oh, wonderful.
Well, then.
Prophecy Keeper, Prophecy Keeper.
Be sure and stay tuned, we'll be returning in just a few moments. Folks, the scriptures say, my people perish for lack of knowledge. We live in a world that's becoming more and more dangerous as time goes by. Millions of people are aware of this fact now and are actively preparing. Back in 2004, the folks here at Prophecy Keepers Foundation foresaw this situation and began preparing information for you. Friends, I seriously suggest that you head over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look at the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library. The Prophecy Keepers Trilogy is a 1,000-page intelligence briefing. The trilogy is a sum total of many years of collecting, collating, analyzing, and comparing prophecies from all over the planet. Mad Bear Anderson predicted that someone would do exactly what we have done. Mad Bear passed into spirit in 1985 before he could realize his dream of collecting and comparing prophecies from all over the world. He said in his biography, someday someone will collect all the native people's prophecies, myths, and legends and would publish them in one place so they could be compared with those of all native peoples worldwide, and then we really will have something. And friends, you'll be absolutely shocked to find out that we discovered exactly what that something was that Mad Bear wanted everyone to know. As it turns out, that certain special something that Mad Bear was searching for in the prophecies has everything to do with your physical safety and how to protect it. Now folks, there's absolutely nothing available on the planet like this collection. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files in 222 folders. You'll also receive direct access to links that will allow you to download all past Prophecy Keepers interviews. Now folks, I won't kid you. Prophecy Keepers does need money to continue to operate. So please head on over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look.
Keepers of great wisdom, truth of other times, let the wind blow.
Crosman and Gamo has a plant about 10 miles north of here in Houston, Missouri. There's quite a bit. Now, Gamo was a Brazilian company. I guess Crosman bought them out, but they've got a plant up here in Houston as a county seat. I live at Kabul, which is in Texas County. It's 70 miles east of Springfield.
Sure.
On U.S. 60. So,
mm-hmm. Let's see, and down there you've got, what? Texas County.
Yep.
And what's the capital of the county seat of Texas County? It's
Houston.
Houston.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah, it was founded by a bunch of people that were from Missouri that decided they wanted to go to Texas. They didn't like it, so they come back and they found this was a sparsely settled area and they formed a county down here in I think about 1840, something like that. It's a beautiful area.
Well, you mentioned Crossman. They hired me to introduce that air rifle they made with a little cylinder in it that holds 12 pellets, and you put in a CO2 cartridge, and it'll shoot 12 times as fast as you pull the trigger.
Was it a rotary?
Yes.
Yeah, those are nice. everybody ought to have, you know, because if we go into the great long emergency that I think we're going to be going into, an air rifle will be your best friend, because you're not going, if you have a, of course I recommend the pneumatic kind, because they last longer than the spring piston ones, and provided the seals don't go dry. The Chinese had a model of air rifle that they sold it with a repair kit that had new leather seals in it. But the pneumatic ones, the ones that cock wants to open, you put a, they break open in half, you put the pellet kind of in a breech, and they also have a higher foot per second, usually above 800 foot per second. There are some that are, some of the better Beemans are, well, I think the one I've got is Crosman, it's about 850. Mm-hmm. And they'll kill small birds and small game. You need to get conical pellets, because people don't understand that 177 caliber kills by hemorrhage, 22 caliber pellets kill by shock. And so the 177, you want something that's conical and will they'll get into the body. And, you know, you can take down small birds with it. And
well, you'd really enjoy that air rifle museum Daisy has at Rogers, Arkansas.
Absolutely. And they're not...
Well, in the medieval times, they had air rifles that had a huge metal... Like a basketball, about the size of a basketball under it was their air supply.
Oh, there was one on the Lewis and Clark expedition.
Yeah, there sure was. They claimed they killed an elk with it.
Absolutely amazing. Well, he had a pretty good sized air chamber on it, and the Indians just loved it.
I'm shooting air guns is the Indian thing to do.
I don't know what, 1803, you know, so I can't remember if it was Lewis or Clark that had it, but... They're a fantastic investment. They're cheap. They're not controlled by the National Firearms Act. And you know, you can buy one for $100, and you know, and store 10,000 rounds of ammo. And you know, you can buy 10,000 pellets for $20-$30.
Right. I've gotten to go to Alaska and shoot bears with a big 416 Magnum and all that. But and you don't shoot that very often. But I shoot my cheap HJBB gun all the time.
Oh, sure, it's a lot of fun.
And I've made an endless flying target machine that I'll have to show you too, Blue Otter. I took a little blower motor and it floats a practice golf ball on a stream of air, and you hit it inside of a tube-like deal, and it knocks it down. As soon as you cock, boy, there your target's up flying again.
Well, Thomas Jefferson said that he firmly believed that the rifle, just strolling with a rifle, a small rifle, was the best form of exercise. Because it would get you out and walk and keep your marksmanship skills going, and you know, put meat in the pot. It's all things that people have forgotten about, but I haven't had a chance to talk much about it on these shows. But you know, we have a large discussion group where we talk about all kinds of things. And in the past, I've talked with people about air rifles, because they're cheap, readily available, and they're not a threat to anybody's army.
Well, now you mentioned the Red Ryder. Red Ryder was three different actors that Hollywood hired, but there is a real cheap AJ and a real cheap AJ BB gun now.
Yeah, that's what I was hearing. And I think that's
not make believe like Red Ryder.
So you know, a lot of people, some people will laugh when you say, oh, there was never any Cherokees in Illinois, but. All you have to do to know where Cherokees were at the time of removal is to read Andrew Jackson's speech about Indian removal to Congress. And then you realize there was Cherokees in places like Nebraska and Iowa, Illinois. They were all over there. Indiana, there were small groups of them all over the place.
Well, in our tribal archives, I had people fill out little questionnaires and things, how their ancestors got to Illinois and everything. On the Trail of Tears, got backed up in Illinois because you could only cross the Mississippi River there in the 1800s a couple times a year.
Yeah.
So everything backed up in Illinois, and the corrupt guards that they had and everything, they made little prison camps and down there in the hills of southern Illinois, and you had all these Welsh and Irish coal miners over here without any women, and the guards sold the Cherokee girls to these miners.
You talk about Green's Ferry down in south of St. Louis, about 100 miles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Greens Ferry. My family ran that ferry. They were the Greens come out here. They were Chickamauga Cherokees, and they came out with Boone when Boone came to Missouri after he settled Kentucky. He came out, and they followed him, and they were here pretty early, and they were mixed blood Cherokees by that time, but the Northern Cherokee Nation, the first two chiefs of the Northern Cherokees were sons and grandsons of my fifth great grandfather.
Well, they knew how tough it was to get across the Mississippi River.
It sure was.
Boy, now you get on the interstate bridge and you go double nickels or faster across there, like nothing. But back then it was hard to get across the river like that.
That's right. Well, another interesting thing is everywhere Cherokees have been, whether it's in Illinois or Missouri or Arkansas or even Iowa, I understand Nebraska, you've got two place names, Pocahontas and Powhatan. And there is a Pocahontas Society in the Cherokee Nation, but no one can really tell you why. But what happened was King Wahun Sunakok, the father of Pocahontas, he married a Cherokee, a very prominent Cherokee woman, stopped the war between the Cherokee Nation and the Powhatans, and they formed something called the Powhatan Confederacy. And they had many descendants. They're known as the Powhatan Cherokees, and they're all over. Some of the earliest names, the Davises, the Rogers, there's all kinds of people that are descended from.
Is the Ross group in there too?
I don't believe the Rosses were, but there's one of the governors, past governors of Illinois or of Virginia, wrote a book about Pocahontas and her descendants. And there's about 2,500 surnames that descend from her. Ross might be one of them. They're mostly English names, of course. And
boy, Blue Otter, you sure got a good knowledge of all that.
Well, I've said a lot of this before, and I'm probably boring everybody but you right now. I probably ought to shut up and let you talk some more about your people and anything else you feel like you ought to be telling the folks about.
Oh, well, just to go to www.chiefagent.com and order my book, Twin Tsunamis, they can get it for $8.53 from Amazon.com.
That'd be great. I'm glad you were able to afford to get it on there. It's not a cheap proposition to get a book on the market, I'll tell you.
Well, it all worked out because this is a way to get their warning out to all those people that are living below sea level in Bullhead City and Laughlin and Needles and Blythe, California, and all along there. It's just like those Tula Indians prophesied that the ocean's coming back.
Isn't that something? Yeah.
And in my book, the second tsunami follows the first one. The first one gets out there in the desert of California and pushes all of the loose gravel and sand and all that, pushes it away down to bedrock. And bedrock in Southern California, that's all your San Andreas faults and everything. And as all the helicopters are overhead and everything, they see something glistening in the sun in the bedrock.
Hmm.
And boy, there goes the gold prospectors.
Really? Now you're aware of all the different seers that have seen the western United States inundated, by flood. Gordon Michael Scallion and Loria Del Toy and just a whole bunch of people. When you realize when you find seashells in Albuquerque, and they found a panel in where a rock art panel where the Ten Commandments were written in Phoenician, and then they realize, look around on the ground, there's seashells around. Well, you realize that Gordon Michael Scallion may have been right when he said that the western U.S. is held up by a magma bubble, and that it's been up above and below sea level different times, and the Hopi have warned that eventually, they're going to have water lapping at either second or third mesa. You're talking at what's now 4,000 foot elevation. If you go to Salt Lake, Lake Bonneville, the shorelines were up about even with the near the spire of the top spire of the Salt Lake Temple. And so, you know, it wouldn't be the first time that there's been a lot of water all over the West. Apparently,
I wasn't aware of how many. I knew that there was other people who've had this spiritual insight about the cleansing of the Southwest and an inland flood caused by tsunamis.
Yeah.
And it's just that it I got all these details in a year and a half, and I just knew I had to get it written down, so I wrote it up in a, with two bears, and everybody that's read it so far, if you're a man, you want to be two bears, and if you're a female and reads Twin Tsunamis, you want to be Professor Pamela Parker.
Well, you could, anybody can, there's a free download on my website, it's called, I have four e-books. They're a trilogy with an introduction to the trilogy, and the first book's called Prophecy Keepers. And you can download that, and there's four or five different people that have all seen, and they have different versions of this map that show how far the oceans eventually will extend. But it's going to be bad out west. Won't be as bad, you know, on the Gulf Coast, but...
Have you heard of David Hatcher Childers?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I've spoken for his group up there at Kempton, Illinois, a couple times.
Oh, interesting. Right.
And the first place I told about the insight in the cleansing of Southwest was one of his conventions there at Kempton.
What do you know about
Adventures Club?
You're from Southern Illinois, right?
Well, Central Illinois.
What do you know about Burroughs Cave?
Oh, no, I haven't heard about that.
That's interesting. You know, that whole area... Southern Illinois down around Cairo has been known as Little Egypt because of all the Egyptian artifacts that have turned up there over, you know, a period of 100 years. But if you go to ancientamerican.com, you can read the story of Burroughs Cave. A fellow by the name of Burroughs some years ago was exploring a graveyard with a metal detector, and he felt a strong pull. He was in a graveyard and felt a strong pull. It led him out of the graveyard and up the side of the hill, and he fell into an 8-foot hole. And, of course, naturally, what you do is you throw your arms up, and he lost the metal detector, but on his belt he had a flashlight, and he'd fallen into a hole, and in there was lots of little black pieces of shale that had... a very fine writing on them, designs of ships and people, and indicating three racial groups. And apparently what had happened is the Mauritanians, you know, during the time of the Mauritanians were the people that that inhabited what's now Morocco. There was a kingdom there. They were The Mauritanians or the Maori or the Mauru were the Phoenicians. And they were a rich kingdom, and they were an autonomous part of the Roman Empire. And when Caligula ran Rome into ruin, he decided he was going to go after them and go after their treasury. So apparently the being traitors, they knew where to go and where not to go in North America. A lot of people have felt that there wasn't enough cedar and there wasn't enough copper in the old world to build Solomon's Temple, and they had to get it from somewhere else. So apparently they went south to Senegal because the Senegalese knew how to build ocean-going boats, and navigated over here and went up the Mississippi River to where the Illini Indians were there in southern Illinois. They were friendly Indians, and they just stayed. Apparently they built a... it's all pretty mysterious. It's a really interesting story. You can read about it at ancientamerican.com. I'll get a link up.
I'll sure go there.
Yeah, I'll get a link up. It'll be from your interview page. Your interview page will be prophecykeepers.com/chiefaj.html. That'll be your permanent link that you can link to from your website. And
yeah, I'll sure do that.
Some of the stuff that you and I have talked about tonight, and that people might want to. But it really is interesting. a lot of his stuff.
There's one other Cherokee legend that I was big on, and they've had me on television in Japan and England and Australia and Canada. I'm the only one that I know of who has photographed giant thunderbirds.
Really? That's interesting. We did a... Ghost Wolf and I did a show about that. You know, are you where they started showing up here in North America again in 1890?
I have that book written by Mark Hall that has all those sightings documented from when they were in the newspapers and everything.
Around 2000, there was a group of soldiers that claimed they shot one down. And there's that old runa, which just means indigenous, an old Mayan prophecy about the condor of the south, and the original old condors were bigger than the ones they've got now.
See, when I was in the Marine Corps, I was a combat photographer, and they trained me with a 16-millimeter wind-up Bell & Howell camera.
Well, that's interesting.
And when I got out of the Marine Corps, I found a camera just like I used. It wasn't painted green. I found it in a pawn shop for $7.50, so I bought it. And then CBS local affiliate here, they hired me to be a stringer and photograph things before video.
Are you talking about... Because I know in Illinois, back in the late 50s or 60s, there was several sightings of thunderbirds.
I'm the one that took the 100-foot of high-quality ectochrome news film of it.
Oh, yeah. Apparently you thought it was like a Piper Cub until it started flapping its wings, right?
Tell me your great secrets deep inside your heart.
I'll see you. Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Folks, the scriptures say, "My people perish for lack of knowledge." We live in a world that's becoming more and more dangerous as time goes by. Millions of people are aware of this fact now and are actively preparing. Back in 2004, the folks here at Prophecy Keepers Foundation foresaw this situation and began preparing information for you. Friends, I seriously suggest that you head over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look at the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library. The Prophecy Keepers Trilogy is a 1,000-page intelligence briefing. The trilogy is a sum total of many years of collecting, collating, analyzing, and comparing prophecies from all over the planet. Mad Bear Anderson predicted that someone would do exactly what we have done. Mad Bear passed into spirit in 1985 before he could realize his dream of collecting and comparing prophecies from all over the world. He said in his biography, "Someday someone will collect all the native people's prophecies, myths, and legends and would publish them in one place so they could be compared with those of all native peoples worldwide, and then we really will have something." And friends, you'll be absolutely shocked to find out that we discovered exactly what that something was that Mad Bear wanted everyone to know. As it turns out, that certain special something that Mad Bear was searching for in the prophecies has everything to do with your physical safety and how to protect it. Now folks, there's absolutely nothing available on the planet like this collection. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files in 222 folders. You'll also receive direct access to links that will allow you to download all past Prophecy Keepers interviews. Now folks, I won't kid you, Prophecy Keepers does need money to continue to operate. So please head on over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look.
Keepers of great wisdom, truth of other times, let the wind blow.
See, they had a $500 reward out for the bird after it picked up 11-year-old Marvin Lowe and carried him 60 yards while his mother was beating on the bird with a broom. And that was in all the newspapers and everything, and they offered this big reward, and so I said, boy, I was going to shoot the thing, and then the Illinois Department of Natural Resources says there'll be no shooting of that big bird. They denied any big bird, and then they said there'd be no shooting them, so I took my 16-millimeter movie camera and filmed two of them.
That's like the U.S. government denies Sasquatch. But they tell the sentries at the U.S. Air Force Academy that if they kill one, they'll be prosecuted for murder.
How's that?
So you were the one that took the
I took that film, and CBS picked it up. Morton Dean had it on the evening news, national CBS, and they were going to fly me out to be on Johnny Carson's show and everything. And then the next day, I got upstaged. The next day, Elvis died.
Oh, you're kidding.
And they forgot all about my Thunderbird film and everything until 20 years later. And then they came all the way over from England and brought a crew, and they reenacted my filming of the Thunderbirds on Lake Shelbyville. And then they had professors. I found the old film that I had shot, and they had all kind of professors analyze it and all this kind of thing. And then Japan saw it, and they bought a copy. And when I'm telling the story, I'm opening my mouth, and Japanese is coming out.
Well, that happened in 77.
77, yes.
Interesting.
And when they were showing it in England, they had this British girl call me up on the phone, asking me questions, and she said, "Were you scared?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, do you ever want to see the birds again?" And I said, "Well, no." And she said, "Well, why not?" And I says, "Because the next day Elvis died."
Yeah. Interesting. So how big do you think this bird was?
It had about an 18-foot wingspan.
Did
you clearly see that in my video?
Did
I was right underneath of it.
Did it look,
it looked kind of evil. It made a clacking sound. The both of them were making clacking sounds to each other.
Did it look like a bird, or look like a pterodactyl?
Well, it didn't look like a pterodactyl. It had feathers. Pterodactyls may have feathers. But, it looked like a huge bird. And the feet, or the claws, or whatever you'd call a foot on a bird, were just absolutely huge.
Well, you know, they had an incident a year or two ago up in Alaska where there was something. Did you hear about those?
Yes, and they tried to film it, and they couldn't get any pictures. A guy flew alongside of it, clicking his camera, and his film didn't come out, and then they had to buy a copy of my film. I have sold that film so many different places now. I guess you had to be an Indian, and you had to be trained to be a photographer in the Marine Corps to be able to get the picture when it counts.
Well, I'll tell you, Red Elk, I'm going to get two of you together, because Red Elk was trained in the Navy because of, see, he was raised in Detroit, but he was taken into medicine societies like the Twisted Hair Society and the Interahelka Society, and he was taught how to observe, and because of that, the Navy picked him up. And he was a long range spotter. He was able to spot ships when they were below the horizon.
Oh wow!
Because of a method. Well, you know how layers of air are. We are looking through. You know, they're thick at the horizon, so you can sometimes see a reflection of what's below the horizon. So he was able to get them when they were like, you know, I can't remember what he said, 30 miles out, and they were well below the horizon. And he was able to teach other guys to do that. With the naked eye.
Mm-hmm.
Because
if you're standing in a rowboat on the ocean, you can only see 3 miles.
Yeah, because of the curvature of the earth. Yeah, he can see out quite a ways. But, yeah, Indians, there's something about them. They have innate abilities that other people don't have. They have talents and a lot of spiritual gifts, particularly that.
Now I'm able to teach a lot of that. I teach instinct shooting, so I'm able to teach. I've found ways to teach that to people.
Well, it's fun and it's a cheap sport. It's something. It helps to have either something launching or somebody to help you out. You know, those tin cans, because you got to start out with something about the size of a tin can and get, you know.
Well, I wanted to make the camera work when it counts, so there wasn't anything mystic about that. You didn't want to bring your camera back without the film exposed properly and report to your Marine Corps drill instructor. There's nothing mystical about that.
Right.
That was all physical.
But
you better get a picture.
Did that bird, did it have a naked neck, you know, like a vulture does, or?
It had a neck like old, cracked, black leather.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So they may not have had a lot of feathers along in there.
Not on the neck, but the feathers in the wing, and the wingspan is so tremendous and such big wings. And the picture out of my 100-foot of Vectorchrome, Morton Dean picked out, is one with the huge wings both up in the air and its huge feet hanging down. And that's one they billboarded it with when they showed it on CBS.
All, pretty much all black bird?
Yes.
Yeah, Ghost Wolf may have seen something like that. It's kind of an enigma. They're associated with a lot of supernatural events also. But was reading the account of that one that a couple years ago that you took the footage of. It was seen, I think they said that it was seen as far north as Pennsylvania and as far south as into the Ozarks.
Well, and they interviewed a Cherokee man from North Carolina who gave the Cherokee legend about the Thunderbirds and everything, and then he described the Thunderbird that he'd seen.
Yeah,
a Cherokee. It's in the video that the British made from my film.
Yeah, the Cherokee remember a dragon being here before white men came also. That's and there's also stories that Rolling Thunder taught about apparently one that was in a cave somewhere in the Smokies, and that if you approach it in a sacred manner and ask it, that it will grant you pretty much anything you want. If you want to be lucky in gambling, or if you want to be lucky in love, or if you want to be a medicine person, then because he had gone there and had asked it, and it had been granted his wish, he became one of the probably the most famous medicine man of modern times. He was studied by the Menninger Foundation, he learned some of his herbal ways under the last grand old herbalist of the Cherokees. Is dead now, but Amanita Sequoia passed away. And his story, you can read about Rolling Thunder at wovoca.com, wovoca/thunderpeople. Read about my teacher, Rolling Thunder.
Yeah, you have done so much research, Bluewater. I think I'll bring you two gifts.
I'll tell you what. Robert Ghost Wolf has forgotten more than I ever knew about all this stuff. And he's a guy that started going to see the Hopi elders in the late 60s and, ended up, hanging around with Frank Fool's Crow and Pete Ketches and traveled, widely. He's been literally all over this hemisphere. He's the guy, we're partnered up with him. We have a new domain. It's trilogymultimedia.com, and if you go there, you'll be able to. There's links to his websites and Prophecy Keepers, and he's planning on doing a radio show hopefully sometime in the future at trilogyradio.com. And we've got Mound Matrix. Mound Matrix is declared a Mayan mystery school, and that's we have that hosted here. And
oh wow,
CuttingEdgeTelevision.com is one of our websites, and Katua-Society.org is one of our websites, and we've got just a little bit of wisdom. Just a little bit of wisdom. So, yeah, you can go go check out trilogymultimedia.com. And,
got it written down.
And, or you can just go to prophecykeepers.com and click on the link at the top.
That's the best way to do it. I didn't get a computer till 61, and now I've learned to manage my website.
So what years were you in the Corps?
I got out in 1958.
Oh, okay, well, you're in some... you went in, what, about 55?
Yeah.
You were entering some interesting years. When were we in the Dominican?
In the what now?
When did the Corps go into the Dominican? What was that, about 58? Dominican Republic?
Yeah, boy, Marine Corps history, I have to think hard to remember all that.
it's amazing the place that the Marine Corps has been sent, and for what reason. everywhere from the Boxer Rebellion to...
That Clinton really depended heavy on sending Marines all around the world there.
Yeah, you know, everybody complains about President Bush, but they don't realize that the Democrats have made more use of military power. World War II was a Democrat war. World War II was a Democrat war. Vietnam was all during Democratic administration. This is the first war, it's a continuation of the first Gulf War, that was prosecuted by Republican administrations, you know. I don't know. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I got out in 58, and now I'm looking at 70, and May 21st, in 35 days, I'm going to be the oldest man ever to enter the Mr. Illinois Physique Contest.
Oh, yeah, well, all anybody has to do is go to your website to see how... Hey, you were telling me, or before we started, you know, about how people can avoid, you know, the Native Americans don't have to get diabetes. And
the Native American, to have this onset diabetes and alcoholism and obesity and all the things that come from this fat, it's fallen my duty to show them they don't have to be that way. And you can live without eating white man's food, and you can be healthy and strong. You know, it says there in the ancient tribal writings, you can renew your strength like an eagle. An eagle, when he starts getting older, he molts, he gets all new feathers, and he continues to soar. And I'm just living proof that you can still soar in your old age. I'm doing two monster workouts a day and a minor third workout getting ready for this. I've been doing it for 120 days, and I'm just getting stronger and stronger, and I'm going to show white man what a man can look like when I step on stage there in Bourbonnais, Illinois, on May 21st.
You consider yourself a bodybuilder, a weightlifter, or a powerlifter?
Well, it's more of a spiritual quest.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I do the exercise and I do the nutrition, but without the spiritual side of it, you don't really get anywhere.
Yeah, I can understand that. Because I know people don't understand. Powerlifters can actually lift more weight than weightlifters, but they don't look bulky. I know about 20 years ago the world champion powerlifter was a Scotsman, wasn't a real big man, but he could outlift a Olympic weightlifter, you know. And
I hold a men's bench press record for men over 60. But I don't try to do all that heavyweight because, you know, that's not helping other Native Americans. Not everybody can go around and then lift weight like that. But, you know, I do a lot of that crane position of the yoga and, you know, following what the animals do and lots of those things along with the weight training that I'm trying to teach people.
Well, it'd be nice to see a book on that, too, because I don't think there are any Native physical training books out there.
Well, I found one video, and it showed how Native Americans did physical training, and it was pretty rigorous. I mean, they took two stakes, two pieces of limb, about as big as your wrist, about 2 foot long,
yeah,
and they extended their whole body on their toes and had a hold of these two sticks, you know, stretched out, and did push-ups that way.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, I mean, that puts it on your shoulders.
Lucille Taylor Hansen, who wrote He Walked the Americas, she also wrote The Ancient Atlantic, she said that she saw an 80-year-old man doing stuff that some of our teenagers can't do. I believe he was a Tiwa, you know, getting out and shooting a rabbit and almost doing somersaults to go after it. It was amazing.
I get in push-up contests with teenagers all the time, and I do just enough to beat them. And they say, how many can you do? And I said, just enough to beat you.
Yeah, right. What did you, I mean, were you in this good a shape when you were in the Corps, or all this happened later on in life?
No, when I was in the Marine Corps, you got $37.50 every 2 weeks.
Yeah.
The only thing I could afford to do at Barstow, California, was to go to the free gym there on the base and train. And I trained pretty hard and pretty serious, and I ate proper. And I got Mr. California and Mr. L.A., and then the Marine Corps saw that that was good PR, so they put me in a big red and gold robe and put three recruiters with me and sent me to all the muscle contests in Southern California.
Like a special services, yeah.
Yeah, that I didn't have to do parades, junk on the buck inspections, and just got out a whole lot of things because I got strong.
That's nice. So you were out at the big supply depot out there at Barstow.
Yes.
I used to play music out of 29 Palms in the mid-70s.
All right.
And my wife's Fresno, and so I know that area. It's quite an area. Kind of forbidding, kind of out in the middle of nowhere. 29 Palms is literally in the middle of nowhere. But I guess they have a big land warfare center, training center out of 29 Palms.
And they sure do. And then Barstow, like you said, was a supply depot, and it was pretty neat because that was where the train came and brought all the food for Edwards Air Force Base.
Yeah, that's right. It's not too far away.
And our master sergeant, the mess sergeant in charge of the mess hall and all the food, he got first pick at all the food, and we ate like Air Force officers.
Oh, I bet you did.
Oh, we got the food before they did.
Yeah, I bet you did. Barstow's not a bad place either. When I was trucking, I used to stop every once in a while there at that first exit just as you get into town. There's a pizza place right in there. I pull my rig up there and pull it right up the front door, go in and order a pizza. And take off, get back on the freeway and head down into, take my deliveries down into L.A. But I like Barstow.
Well, then you drove to, El Cajon Pass?
Yeah. And I knew how to beat that scale there, too. It's kind of interesting, you know, that scale there at El Cajon was always getting backed up. You know, and I did not mind going through scales at all, except that one. Because they would back you up, make you stand in line, you know, back a mile. So, you know, I was just, whether you're eastbound or westbound, you could get on the exit, which was only a half mile away, and you could just wait till they close the scale, then jump on the freeway and run right by it. So.
Keepers of great wisdom, truth of other times, let the wind blow.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Folks, the scriptures say, "My people perish for lack of knowledge." We live in a world that's becoming more and more dangerous as time goes by. Millions of people are aware of this fact now and are actively preparing. Back in 2004, the folks here at Prophecy Keepers Foundation foresaw this situation and began preparing information for you. Friends, I seriously suggest that you head over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look at the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library. The Prophecy Keepers Trilogy is a 1,000-page intelligence briefing. The trilogy is a sum total of many years of collecting, collating, analyzing and comparing prophecies from all over the planet. Mad Bear Anderson predicted that someone would do exactly what we have done. Mad Bear passed into spirit in 1985 before he could realize his dream of collecting and comparing prophecies from all over the world. He said in his biography, "Someday someone will collect all the native people's prophecies, myths, and legends and would publish them in one place so they could be compared with those of all native peoples worldwide. And then we really will have something." And friends, you'll be absolutely shocked to find out that we discovered exactly what that something was that Mad Bear wanted everyone to know. As it turns out, that certain special something that Mad Bear was searching for in the prophecies has everything to do with your physical safety and how to protect it. Now folks, there's absolutely nothing available on the planet like this collection. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files in 222 folders. You'll also receive direct access to links that will allow you to download all past Prophecy Keeper's interviews. Now folks, I won't kid you, Prophecy Keeper's does need money to continue to operate. So please head on over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look.
Keepers of great wisdom, truth of other times, let the wind blow.
Well, you went through Victorville.
Yeah.
Apple Valley.
Yeah.
I used to, but I graduated from university in 79 and was an executive with the Boy Scouts down out of near San Bernardino. But that my service area was San Bernardino, and but yeah, Roy Rogers.
See, I'm in the Roy Rogers Dale Evans Museum there at Victorville.
Yeah, they were still alive there. They used to come down to the Bun Boy restaurant. What was it, on Thursday afternoons? You'd come down, anybody want to, in the mid-70s, would come down and meet Dale and Roy, the Bun Boy.
Yeah, I got to tour with him for a while, and then the pictures of that and everything, they put it there in the museum, and he and I traded guns, and they put the gun that I traded to him there, and then I've got the one that he traded to me.
You know, he is an Indian.
Yes,
yeah,
and the first child they adopted was a little Indian girl.
Yeah, I can't remember what, but you, all you have to do is just look at... Dale has what they call a pyracanthal fold. It's that kind of looks almost oriental, but and it gets more pronounced as you get older, but that's a dead giveaway of native blood. I can't remember what kind of Indian he was, Choctaw or something, but his wasn't his real name. His real name was, do you remember what it was?
Leonard. Yeah, Lux Snodgrass.
Yeah, Leonard something was a one-syllable last name, and he was quite a guy. I just loved him, and I loved watching the reruns and Trigger. But my favorite was that old Jeep that had old Nellie Bell.
Right. So I got to tour with Roy Rogers. That was RR. And then when our little tribe was Minority Contractor of the Year, I got to go and meet Ronald Reagan. And there's another RR cowboy.
Yeah.
And now I'm playing with Red Ryder.
Isn't that something?
Another RR cowboy. It's cowboys and Indians now.
Well, you ought to read the story of Damien Brinkley. Damien Brinkley had a near-death experience. Damien Brinkley had a near-death experience, and he, back in the 70s, he was struck by lightning, and he had two near-death experiences. He died twice and came back after, 15, 20 minutes, but he was shown that there was going to be a president who had been an actor whose initials were RR. At that time, Ronald Reagan wasn't even into politics. He kind of wondered if it was Robert Redford. But he was given 113 prophecies.
Wow.
Shown, he was like little television sets. And he wrote them all down, and it's just amazing what he saw. And see, he'd been a killer for the Phoenix Project in Vietnam. They took him out of the Marine Corps. He was such an efficient killer. I think he was a sniper, and he just worked for the CIA. And he said the first time he died and had his life review, he had to endure the pain of not only everybody he killed, but all their families. All the ripple effect of everyone, all of their sadness also. The children that would have been born and weren't born, and. But see, he'd been a very, very nasty person as a child and as a teenager. He was hated because he would always beat up on people and, cheat them in the store, his parents' store. He was a very negative person. But after that experience, he cleaned up his act and started picking up homeless people and feeding them and going into hospices and helping out with people that were dying. But, somebody just about killed him. Hit him over the back of the head with a 2x4, so he had to move out of his hometown. But he eventually was able, after his second near-death experience, it wasn't near as bad as the first one, apparently, because he had repented and he changed his mind about being such a negative person. And,
well, I believe all that, and I think that's reason enough just to be a decent person without having to go through all that.
Yeah, he was a pretty sad guy, and he's still got his troubles, and he and You know, everybody does. He's a pretty good friend of Ghost Wolf's, and but he does a lot of touring and still writing books, and that's quite a story. If they're really, you know, the metaphysical world, whatever you want to call it, paranormal, metaphysical, absolutely fascinating. I've been tickled to death to have you on the show, and hope to have you on sometime again in the future. And be sure to keep in touch. And if you see something, we invite all of our guests, if they see something that's interesting, that they feel I ought to know about, if they send an email to me, I send it out to the Native Prophecy Council. We have a mailing list that has about 400 people on it, and we discuss all kinds of things. We have another one that just lets people know if there's a new show coming on. And we have one that's just a new one that's just for women. It's called the Red Heart Women. And, you know, folks that are listening are sure welcome to come on and to join the discussion groups. It's all free, and the listening is free also. But,
well, good. It's been a great honor to be on with you, Blue Water.
Well, ours mine. Appreciate talking with you.
Okay.
And thanks a lot, Chief AJ.
Right. We'll catch you on down the stream.
Wado, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Amen.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Let the truth be known to all mankind again. Prophecy keeper, prophecy keeper, prophecy keeper.
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius.
Prophecy keeper, prophecy.
Thank you.